brought to you by bedroombattlefield.com. This is the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. Back at the beginning of May, our Discord community was awash with some fantastic photos of another massive game that took place down in darkest Englandshire. Was this actually a 28mm game of Man of War, or was it just a game of Warhammer with a lot of sea and a lot of ships involved? On this episode of the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast, I'm joined by Jason and Mark, and we're going to find out a bit more about it all.
Yeah, so we've already done a couple of big games, so Jason and myself and others, and the first one we did was April last year, 2024, and then we did one in October. So this was the third one that we were doing, and they're all kind of part of a bit of a campaign series of this narrative Jason's put together. And this one was themed around a big multiplayer game on a big long table in the village hall near Jason. And it was a game of Warhammer, but not Warhammer as you know it. It was Warhammer with boats and with a big narrative mission to get on board this island and get some treasure. So it was very unusual, very cool, and really good fun.
So Jason, was this kind of like a large-scale Man of War, like a 28mm Man of War crossover, or was it just the fact that there was boats in Warhammer?
I think that's essentially what it was in the end, is the fact that it was boats in Warhammer. We tried Man of War, and it didn't really port over easily, because Mark and I did a bit of Spoonhammer, which sounds more lewd than it actually was. I don't know what you thought, Mark, about the Man of War going over to 28mm, but it didn't feel quite right.
Yeah, I think Man of War works well because it's a bit like Epic in 40K. Man of War's got that zoomed out look to it. And what we wanted is something that wasn't really naval. It was more just the ships arriving at a harbour outside the island and then all smashing into each other and boarding. So it was kind of essentially the boat movement and how the boats worked was the very simple part of it. And actually, mainly, we were playing a kind of skirmish level, warband level game of Warhammer on moving terrain, essentially.
So, Mark, how many of yous actually played in this game?
I think we had, I've forgotten now, but it was, there was nine or ten, I can't remember. Jason. Something like that, isn't it, Jason? So, and it was, everyone had a boat, everyone had a warband of, it was 250 points, so that in Warhammer would, if it was goblins, it would get you a lot of goblins. If it was, in my case, elves, not very many, but, you know, it was still a small number of figures, and everyone had at least one boat, some people had two. So, yeah, on the table, there was, at the very beginning of the game, about 12, 13 massive boats, you know, some of them sort of 2 feet long. The smallest boat was still, you know, pretty big and enough to hold several figures. So, yeah, it was really packed in, and it was, as a result, very chaotic. But I think actually it worked in our favour and it really was part of the fun. But we did divide ourselves up into a kind of loose goodies and baddies alliances, which was a really good way of kicking the game off. But then, as these alliances usually are, they kind of started getting frayed very quickly, which was good fun too.
So, Jason, what was the narrative here like for the game?
I've been writing in my mind about a necromancer that's turned evil and turned on one of the provinces of the Empire. And its Elector Count is his particular nemesis. He doesn't like him at all. And we've just been using that as a framework in which to springboard various games that I just want to introduce to people for big participation games with a bit more of an emphasis on games mastered narrative play, like Rick Priestley and all them lot wrote about in the 80s and early 90s, just to give it a go because I've never played like that before. And so we built off that, and then Mark mentioned to me at a Spoonhammer event too, what about if we did a big Skull Island thing? So we wrote in there an idea that this rumor had come by of this magical warp stone generated soul orb that had been lost for centuries, and they found evidence that it was located on this special Skull Island where a undead pirate stashed all his loot. And so everyone went for a rush there, and you had to get onto the nearest boat, get your nearest crew, and go and try and claim it. And it turned out, I have to say, because Mark came up with most of the narrative on this particular mission and shoehorned it into my overarching idea, it turned out to be possibly the best game I've ever played.
And why was that?
The narrative events, how they unfolded and how they overlapped and how each decision of individual players ended up being absolutely crucial to the cinema finish at the end. If one of those things hadn't have happened, such as my loosely allied partner Dylan decided that he was going to use the Hand of Gork to transport orcs from ship to ship, but not his orcs, my orcs, just to get them out of his way, but on, and then to entangle them in some enemy's face, which I didn't want him to do, but he did it. And that allowed certain other enemies to get in front in such a way that towards the end, I mean, I don't, Mark, did you share the battle report in the end?
Oh, no, not yet. Wait, that's a very good reminder. Jason, you sent it to me to have a look over, and I have been so frantic and busy at work, I completely forgot. So, yeah, I must do that and have a look at it, because Jason's written up a really nice battle report. So we've got to share that. It would also be nice to share it with anyone else who's wanting to publish a bit of content, because it was really spectacular, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of people really interested in it.
Yeah, I mean, the photos looked brilliant. I was embarrassingly quite late to the party. I'd only just noticed it. Like, I don't know if it was a week or two later, but Mark, talk me through your preparations for the game, because obviously a game like this, like, preparations will start well in advance of turning up on the day. So what were the types of things that you painted or built for this game?
Yeah. So actually, you're right. This was particularly unusual because the terrain that we needed was the main thing. We needed this Skull Island, and we also needed boats. I mean, getting a few figures together for a warband, that's the easier bit with this one. So really, it was a case of, I think we decided to do this around about Christmas time. So I had about 4 months to do it. So I decided I was going to make this island, and I just had some old packing foam from like a kettle or something like that, and just laid it out on you know, you can get those, they like look like jigsaw puzzle pieces, and they're like a EVA foam mat that you can put down in like playrooms and gyms and stuff like that. So I got some of those cheaply and used those as a base and just built this big island, most of which was covered in air drying clay rocks that I'd pushed into one of those rubber rock molds that you could get, and just built it up and up and up. And it ended up being quite big, but it was really cool actually. And I was really pleased with how it looked. And so that was kind of a nice centerpiece to it. And Jason had all this, this blue, what would you call it? It's like a leatherette type stuff that you put underneath the tablecloth to protect your table. But it was like a royal blue, and that looks really smart for seawater. So we had all that terrain. I mean, we got there in the end. It took me longer than I thought to build the island, because I kept on having to like wait for everything to dry and then put more on it. And it's enormous, this thing. It's now in my shed, completely in the way. But I'm really glad I built it. So there was that, but there was also the boats as well. So I went for the kind of easier option and got some MDF kits of these boats from TT Combat, and they were really cool. But I've got to be honest, I was a little bit embarrassed when I got there, because some of the boats that people had made are handcrafted things. People had made things out of balsa wood. People had made things from, like, you know, cutting up. Jason cut up a flask, I think, to make his. And there was this one that you've probably seen pictures of that's a flying dwarven airship that was just absolutely stunning. But not to, you know, put down any of the others. And Ed made this Skaven doom wheel on sea. It was, so the making the boats bit was ace, because it wasn't just on us. It was kind of everyone did that as part of a wider community of people in preparation for the event, which was lovely to see. It was really kind of get into the event and get excited about it as it was building up.
What about you, Jason? What was your preparation like in terms of building or painting or anything like that?
I made a load of gribblies that were going to be just jumping out at people at random occasions, so random monsters that would be generated by the activity of the game. And I made myself a submersible for my Uruk-hai. So I was the only submarine on the board. But I can't thank the players enough for the effort that they went to make their ships. I mean, some of those ships are so wonderfully made. And even the 3D printed ones were so characterful and fun. It really made the day. And just to answer your question from earlier, the reason it was the best game ever because of those character points and those events stacking on top of each other in such a way that you'd never believe, but it was absolutely essential for the final finish for Ed, who would never have had a moment where Jeff had opened the final Skull Island vault of treasure by accidentally turning it into a wandering monster. That monster fell over and killed itself, opened itself to Ed, who then stole the jewel, ran to the top of the island to do a death-defying leap onto an abandoned dwarf airship, which had been all its crew had been shot and killed and stolen by a Chaos Sorcerer, who was then shot and killed by the dwarves on the ground, letting it float by so that Ed could just barely, on a roll of 5 or 6, jump on and steal the treasure. It was the best game I've ever had, and it's because it was in that style of the 80s and 90s.
Mark, how long did the game take? How long did the day take from getting there and setting up to basically putting everything away?
We started setting up about it was all day. So we started setting up about 9-ish, and then everyone had arrived by 10, and I think we cracked on where we were going by 10:30. But that first sort of 15 minutes, there was also, we had to do a bit of briefing explaining the rules. So we did some handouts to give to people, giving people that bit of a sort of reassurance that, you know, we are slightly making this up, but we'll make decisions as we go, and kind of getting that consensus that that it was going to be a participation game that we were all in together. And it wasn't a sort of straight Games Master role, because everyone was playing, but there was people were sort of prepared to, you know, sort of invest in, let's make this the best narrative game that we can make it. So there's that bit of briefing. But we got going about 10:30, and we wrapped up, I think, at about 6, something like that, off the top of my head. And we didn't really stop for lunch. We were kind of all the way go through. We didn't really get through that many turns, but as the pace of the game was kind of moving on and people were getting killed, it all sped up a bit. And actually, you know, we used the opportunity to say, well, let's introduce some chaotic elements. So we had a wind dial, for example, and the wind was occasionally blowing against the ships and causing them issues, which meant they couldn't really travel very quickly. So, okay, we'll create a magical event that means that the wind will push everyone towards the island and kind of suck them in. So we kind of work with the clock in a flexible way to try and make the game flow as best as we could. So it was a lot of gaming and a lot of play, but it didn't feel like a long day in a sense, because it was always moving and always changing. It felt like you were at different phases of the narrative all the way through. Like the beginning of the game was very naval, and the end of it was very almost RPG-like, as Jason's explained, you know, with the whole getting into the treasure and escaping with it. It was really great. And although it was only sort of Ed who was playing at that final moment, everyone was really rooting for his character to see what would happen, which was cool.
Question for both of you is starting with Jason. Like, you know, when you have a game of this scale, when you've been preparing it for half a year and, you know, you've done so much work, do you get that moment of clarity at any point when you're actually playing the game, where you're like, Christ, I'm actually playing this right now? Like, you know, that kind of moment to smell the roses, if you like, or is it just, does it go past in a blur? Like, how did that kind of work out for you?
For me, it was an absolute blur, because there's a lot of anticipation and hoping that I've set it up in a way that people will enjoy. And then when it actually comes to the day, it's the players that bring such enthusiasm, and they are changing the game from what I thought it would be. It never ends up the way I think it would, because the players actively change what's going on during play. And so, like Mark said, although it's technically a long day, I don't think anyone felt like it was a long day at all. From what I got the sense of is actually, we're all very conscious that, oh, we should be leaving for home now, but actually we want to finish this. Is that engaging? And so it does go with a blur. And it's always a surprise for me how the players' decisions completely change what I think is going to happen. So it's really quite entertaining.
I think Jason hit the nail on the head. It's sort of it both is a blur, but also it feels there's sometimes it's like time speeding up and slowing down simultaneously. It's really quite exciting. I think the moment for me that was, there's a kind of real moment of like not so much a moment of clarity, but a real moment of it being so worthwhile, a real purposeful moment, was one of the participants, he'd brought along his son, and he was playing, and he was really excited and into it. And, you know, it's just fantastic to see someone who's, you know, one of Jason's local club members. And it's just fascinating to see how he was really understanding the game in this really narrative way. He wasn't thinking about rules and rolling dice. He was thinking about the story and what would my characters do. He was playing goblins and he was behaving in a goblin-like way. And he bounced a spell back at my wood elf mage that ended up creating a major catastrophe at the other end of the board. And it's just like, there was just this moment where he was just so in the zone and so enjoying it. And it was great because it was, you know, yes, Jason and I and others have kind of facilitated that and be able to prepare that and put that on so he could enjoy it. But it's what he brought to the table that was the kind of enzyme that activated all of those ingredients and made them happen. That was a really cool moment. Would you agree, Jason?
100%. 100%. And I would add that he said to me after that he's not really enjoyed games like that before, that he's never played one like that. He's been playing Warhammer 40,000 with his friends and over the clubs fairly regularly, and they've never played games like this, and they're so enthusiastic for them. I think we've got a strain of gamers that have been unsatisfied with the modern pick-up-and-play way of gaming with strangers at clubs. I'm sure that we're not the only ones that have been doing this, but obviously it's not as common as perhaps it once was from the signals I'm getting from these youngsters. And it really does, it fires me up to see them doing it and see them getting into it. And the visual spectacle and the social elements of it make it so worthwhile, all the prep.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about, like, you know, you hear about folks that are able to play every week or every month or whatever. And, you know, part of me envies that. But on the flip side, like, if you did just prepare for a game for 6 months and played something like this, I think there's equal worth in that. Like, it's a totally different way of doing things. But seeing the type of game you could create with that much preparation and getting that much people involved, like, it's... Yeah, I could totally see the appeal of that, and I get the impression it's something that you definitely want to keep doing, Mark.
Yeah, no, definitely. I would say you're right. In terms of preparation, it's not easy work, but it's enjoyable work. And actually, all, you know, the 5 months and 29 days or whatever that you're not playing are still enjoyable, and it doesn't feel to me that this is an unsatisfying way of doing it because you're only doing something very infrequently. It feels like it's got a really seasonal quality to it where you're building something up over a period of time and then you're seeing the fruits of it, that delayed gratification where, you know, it really is substantially better than something that you could have quickly done, to me. And I know that wouldn't be for everyone, but I think if you really do want to see that spectacle, and I think it would be fair to say as well, when you look back at all three games that we've done, the big games that we've put on, the amount, I think every single one of them, someone has kind of commented that almost this sort of disbelief of how is this even possible? But they're seeing it with their own eyes. Of course it's possible. It is happening, and we've done it. And no one's, you know, had to remortgage their house or give up their job to be able to find the time or money to do it. You know, it's resource intensive to some extent, but so are lots of things. And actually it really feels very valuable use of time and resources, I'd say.
Jason, do you ever think about, like, if 12-year-old you could, like, just see you playing a game like that, like, what would they have thought to see that?
What, 12-year-old me is here. This is what I've been waiting for. One of the big things that I've struggled with is participants, if I'm being honest. And what I mean by that isn't that I'm some antisocial sod, that this doesn't know how to get people involved. It's that most people seem to struggle, in some sense, to find the willpower to participate in a lot of things, not just in our hobby. My wife finds it in the PTFA. Schools are finding it with participation. Sports are finding it hard to get players. People aren't finding it as easy to step into social situations as they once were, whether it's because they're busy or whatever. And when they do, it's magic. It's so fun. So that 12-year-old me is buzzing now because, you know, I don't distinguish between the two. I've been working towards, well, this is possibly the best time of my hobby life. Because, you know, I'm old enough to do things in a bit more of a disciplined manner. And I don't mean disciplined in a boring way. I just mean actually get things done. And I can plan for things and put resources into things and get enthusiastic about things in a way that wasn't possible when I was a teenager. Just wasn't accessible to me, so I had to rely on adults to do it. And completely buzzing as a 12-year-old. I'm quite interested in what Mark said. Do you mind if I ask him a question in return?
Of course. Go on. They'll be better than my questions.
I just want to say it's quite resource intense. What resource did you think, Mark? What did you have in mind? Because I've not found too much costs or in what I do for various reasons, but I just want to know what you're meaning.
Yeah, I think you're right. I don't think it's necessarily cost. I think it's just the fact that you've got to allocate some time and some money to doing it. So it needs to be something that you want to do. And you also need to allocate it in a way that's a little bit over a longer period of time. So you can't say, oh, well, I could get into this game and have a few games of that. If I don't like it, I'll sell it. And it's a little bit more of a long-term purchase in that respect. And I think that it's a little bit like, you know, renovating a house rather than going on holiday. It's more of a long-term burn thing. However, I think that the nostalgia and the kind of wanting to create something that's out of the pages of White Dwarf from when you were a kid, for me, is the thing that propels me on to want to do that. So although I've got other things that I'm doing as well in the hobby, you know, this kind of fantasy, big fantasy armies in 28 mil is kind of where my head's at most of the time in terms of wanting to do stuff. So, and also I think the very freeing notion as well, which I know you very much agree with, Jason, that kind of idea that being, okay, well, I'm going to do this my way. I'm going to put together stuff. It doesn't all have to fit. You know, it doesn't all have to be of the exact same type. It doesn't all have to be the same range of figures or the same game or the same rules. Or it can be whatever you want it to be. And actually, that is a very freeing idea. And that kind of perhaps helps make it seem less of a big long-term purchase and more of a sort of slow developmental thing.
You should ask Jason a question now. I'll just kick back and...
Yeah, I've got a quick question for you. I have got a question for Jason, actually. What do you think is the benefit of playing a game that doesn't just come out of a box, that isn't just a thing? And it's harder to describe to someone, but what's the benefit of doing something like we've been doing, which is a big kind of ideas cake?
I'm still finding the benefits, because I'm still exploring this, because I'm finding my enthusiasm is completely fired by what we're doing. So I haven't completely got an answer for you, other than the fact that it's unique. There is a value to the uniqueness of it. It is entirely reliant upon participation from other players and how that they, you know, almost role-playing, but it's not role-playing because you can learn through tactics. It's a mid-ground way of doing things. But they bring such unique flavor to the event, and everyone else is then fired up by those things that happen. And it's a visual spectacle that tied in to that social element of fun that you just wouldn't get by being a hobby butterfly. And it's a special event. You can't do it common. You can't do it commonly unless you're supremely rich and you have staff. But for all that, it feels so special and quite connecting. And I never forget games that I play like this, no matter what scale. And, you know, whether it's a 30-foot by 6-foot board like we've been doing, or whether it's an 8-foot by 4-foot, that is, it's these special narrative scenarios. I just don't forget them. And I don't think other players do either. It just lodges in their mind. I mean, I can't imagine any other situation where someone who would decide that they're going to make something completely within the narrative of the IP, you know, being Warhammer, of a dwarf blimp. But to go to such effort to make a beautiful model that is integral to the game and actually dominated the gameplay's narrative in the end, because it was so special and how it functioned during the game that has no specific rules to it. And it became everyone's favorite thing of the day, and actually the most cinematic moment at the end for the reasons that you wouldn't predict. I can't fully put an explanation on that value, but Ed on the day said it quite well to me, so it might be worth chatting to him quick at some point, because he's more familiar with role-playing games. And he said, this is what the magic of role-play is, but you've got it in a more structured environment with that visual spectacle that you wouldn't get in role-play. And it's more structured in the gameplay, which brings in more players than you would get in a role-playing game as well. Now, I don't think I've done full service the way Ed would explain it, but he said that's what's missing from most games of, say, modern-day 40K, where you have equal sides, predictable scenery, blah, 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 blah. You know the games I mean. Mm. And he says that's the element that's being mixed in and blended with that other style of gaming. And that really brings value in a way that I've not truly experienced, apart from in rare occasion, and now it's a common occasion, or at least regular.
If you're one of those kind-hearted people who tips their servers, taxi drivers, and bar staff, how about tipping your favourite podcaster too? And if you've any money left after that, how about tipping me? If you appreciate the work that goes into putting this show together, or if this episode's simply helping you to pass the time whilst you work, drive or paint, then you could leave a little something by going to bedroombattlefields.com/tip. That's bedroombattlefields.com/TIP. And now, back to the show. A massive thanks to Jason and Mark for having a wee chat about what was a very, very big and exciting sounding game. You'll no doubt be keen to look at all the pictures that we talked about there, so get yourself over to the Discord community if you're not there already. It's absolutely free. It's bedroombattlefields.com/Discord, and you'll find it all in there, all the photos and everything around the game, and also, crucially, details about whenever the next one might be planned or played. So from one game to another, Callum, Dr. Spork, was kind enough to travel through to meet me for another game, and we were playing my very own rule set, Blaster Station. This is a solo co-op rule set where you take a party of heroes from one corner of a 4x4 table over to the other corner. You've got the entrance corner, you navigate through the table, show the NPCs, try and pick up the treasure on the way, and then get off at the opposite corner of the table. So this is the second time we've played this game, but this time around we were doing it in its sci-fi iteration, and Callum brought through all the terrain and the mat and most of the miniatures, so it was a really great experience because he's a phenomenal painter, he's a phenomenal 3D printer, and you know the way that the table was laid out was fantastic. It was, I say this a lot, but you know, just out of the pages of White Dwarf, but I mean sometimes I say that about my own stuff and it's not really true, but you know, when you're playing with Callum's stuff, it really does look like it's right out the pages of that magazine, circa sort of 1994-1995. So it was great to play that game in such an environment, and we had a lot of fun with the game itself. We're going to get into that, but we kicked things off with a ceremonial exchanging of gifts. So he was kind enough to create these. You basically need spawn point markers for Blaster Station, and he'd made these wee like 3D printed manhole covers with the Bedroom Battlefield logo. So as we started, it's just me opening the packet of them. So let's dive into it. Oh, so it's like wee manhole covers. I'll obviously put a photo up of these with the Bedroom Battlefields logo.
Yeah, well, that's, I needed 14 spawn points for this.
Yeah, so they're lovely.
I thought I'd bring them along. I didn't actually quite manage to finish painting them properly. They were quite hastily painted, but they'll do the job.
It's better than I could have painted them. So we have, spawn points, and you brought all this scenery over. The table looks brilliant. I was just saying to you before we started recording, like, I'm so glad not to be using my scenery, because as much as I like it, I've used it again and again and again, and it's starting to lose its kind of imagery to in my mind, so it needs a bit of a rest. So talk us through, like, and you were saying you're equally just as delighted to be getting this stuff on the table now, so.
Yeah, I mean, I've been working on this for 2 years between designing it and painting it and everything, and I finally got a hold of one of the old Citadel battle mats, which looks great. So yeah, no, it's a nice bright table for us to have Jeff run around on.
Yeah, it's a very 90s White Dwarf 40K game, isn't it?
Yeah, it's basically my nostalgia distilled into 3D prints.
And you've brought a lot of miniatures here, so talk us through what we're playing with.
Well, we've got the bad guys who are from my Gene Steel Occult Army that I've been working on. So we've got a bunch of guys who are the big, tough guys for this are going to be some of the Gene Steeler proxy miniatures from Old School Miniatures. And then we've got a bunch of the smaller guys who are the tech cultists from Checkpoint Miniatures. And they go quite well together. They've got a similar vibe going on. And then, of course, we've got the heroes for my team, which is Jeff, the space wizard, and his new pals, Clive and Urson, who I painted up recently just
Clive
for this.
And Urson, yeah, that's excellent.
And you're adding three of your own guys into this, I believe.
Yeah, well, the reason I think that Clive and Urson are present here with Jeff is because I told you that my my three guys that would be accompanying you are from the Gibb Mercenary Company. So we've got Barry, Robin, and Morris. So they'll be.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to get on.
Yeah, I think there's a decent chance somebody will be walking off. I mean, that is the aim of the game, to walk off, I suppose. So
that's true, yeah.
We're well set up on that front. I do love the hazard stripes on the... Is it a chainsword?
Yeah, yeah, on everything, basically.
We had a good laugh on Discord about this a while ago, didn't we, about hazard stripes on weapons. Like, it's just great to see, you know, in a post-apocalyptic sci-fi future that we're still health and safety compliant with hazard stripes, so...
Well, I think there was some discussion about it being that the tech priests see it as almost a religious thing in 40K.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, we must paint hazard stripes on things as it was done, as it has always been done.
Yeah.
So they just slap it on everything and go.
So I had a couple of wee things to give you.
All right.
There's two things, actually, in this wee jiffy bag.
What have we got?
So,
these
come with these come with conditions. These gifts. So what we got there, the miniatures.
We got my very own Goatsy, I believe.
Goatsy,
yeah.
Got a new Goatsy.
Godson of Goatsy, maybe.
Yeah.
and my very own naked pick.
Yeah. So what I'm giving you these, but with the conditions that I want them turned into sci-fi Goatsy, space Goatsy, space Hector.
Right, so, okay, I'm sure I can manage that. Thank you very much.
When those get used, they'll have guns or whatever. I'd like to see that. So
I feel honoured to have my very own Goatsy, especially. And
you know what? I thought I'd thrown Goatsy out. So last night I came up here because I'd brought like some stuff up last night to the office, including the rules and that. And I'd been looking for Goatsy. Nobody's ever said that. I'd been looking.
I know someone has.
Otherwise, it wouldn't have such good SEO. I'd been looking for Goatsy in the house, couldn't find him. And good God. So I was like, Goatsy must be in the office. Again, nobody ever said that before. I came up here, Goatsy wasn't here. So I was like, what I thought had happened was Midlum sent the stuff out in the wee cardboard box, and I thought I'd left it in the box when the viewer given the box to you, and then I'd put that in the cardboard recycling, which had just been emptied yesterday. So I was like, I think Goatsy's in the landfill, basically. I think he's going to be recycled. Anyway, long story short, I did find Goatsy. He wasn't thrown out. So, yeah. Cool story, bro.
Yeah, no, well, that's good. Well, yeah, no, I certainly got a laugh out of that.
Yeah, looking for Goatsy.
Yeah, is that the name of your autobiography?
Exactly, yeah. Alrighty then, that's the last die rolled. So close, wasn't it? So agonisingly close.
Yeah, we actually need... We really didn't think we were going to make it.
No.
The game, I mean, it could have been harder, but it really did. It was really punishing. We lost, well, spoilers, we lost the brothers' game.
Yeah, all three of them passed away. I mean, starting at the end, I suppose, like we had to get Jeff off the table with the lads, Clive and Urson. Jeff found what he was looking for. Was his lucky rabbit's foot?
Yeah, I hadn't quite decided yet. I think we'll just go with Lucky Rabbit's foot. He dropped it somewhere and refused to leave without it, so they had to go looking for it before they could get out the warp portal.
Yeah, I mean, the three treasure points, we had centre of the board and we had way up in the left corner and way down in the right corner. We went for the middle first, searched that, didn't find it. got down to the right, didn't find it. And then we had that stroke of luck, didn't we, where Jeff, during the Jeff phase, he accidentally transported himself. He swapped places with one of the gene stealers, which put him like basically at the treasure, didn't
it? Right next to it. So he just picked it up in the next turn. So.
Yeah. But the game clock, again, this was to do with the Jeff phase as well, but a couple of times on in the Jeff phase, he added like, we had to roll a D12 and add that to the game clock because he'd messed with the space-time continuum. Mm. So that put a bit of strain on the clock, didn't it? And it was the clock that beat us in the end. Like, what did you measure? He was two turns away from getting away.
Yeah, he was. And considering we had 13 turns the whole game, mm-hmm. so put that into perspective. So, you know, they're quite quick turns.
Yeah.
So it wasn't that far away. But... Yeah.
So I made some notes of like key events. Starting with like Barry Gibb, he didn't start the game very well. He very quickly accumulated like 4 wounds. So he spent a fair chunk of the game on 4 wounds, and obviously not obviously to the listener, but the heroes, they have 5 wounds. Hmm. So he was he became a bit of an eggshell. But he actually went on to have a decent game, like killed a few folk.
Yeah. So, and he was a good distraction for a good few of them at the end.
Yeah.
Keep them away from Jeff as he was sprinting past.
Yeah.
That's what eventually killed him, was a swarm of like autograph hunters.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've noted down here that Jeff had messed with the game clock a couple of times. We got hit by this tremor event as well. So we've got the event phase and, I think it was 3 times it came up. We had to move all our heroes 4 inches back towards the starting point. Mm. So that was a bit frustrating. What else did we have here? Yeah, Jeff, 3 times he had the opportunity to get that chain lightning spell off.
Yeah, never once managed it. Yeah. I think at least twice of those times I rolled a 1 on the first roll.
Yeah, so I mean, that would have been quite thematic because the spell would have... we needed an 8 or up to wound the nearest NPC, and if we'd managed that, it would have went to the next nearest, and so on. So in theory, you could wound every single NPC. Hmm. We wounded none.
Yeah,
so.
not a single one. Every single time, it just fizzled out. Jeff needs to go see the apothecary about that.
One of the funny moments as well, Jeff took over the mind of a newly spawned gene stealer cultist who just climbed out the manhole cover.
Yep.
Jeff immediately mind controlled him, that's not the term, but took over his mind, and he promptly shot one of his pals and killed him, didn't he?
So, yeah, which was very handy.
Yeah. What else did we have here? So, yeah, when your hero's dying, you don't immediately remove them because we've still got the hero's phase, so they get to take their turn with like a few advantages, like it's just the adrenaline or that of a dying hero, I suppose.
It's that cinematic moment.
Yeah.
That like kind of hero, last gunshot, kind of before they die.
So when Morris Gibb was dying, he had the opportunity to basically kill the cultist that had killed him. And then he went and rolled 2 ones in a row. So it was like the least heroic death ever. And shout out to his brother Robin as well, because he, like, how many shots did he have at that cultist, like right on the far table edge, and he just kept rolling
like
ones.
2 or 3 turns, he just was like, going at him full blast,
he was actually hurting himself because each time he rolled a 1, the guy shot back at him, and then like he was actually picking up wounds himself. So he eventually died.
Oh, he did. He did come good in the end when he died.
Yeah, when he was dying.
Well, yeah, because on that day when he died, he did actually manage to take out one of the cultists and wound another. So
the Gibb brothers all died. You kept your team alive, didn't you?
Yeah, actually, I'm not too bad. None of them are even over half wounds. So it's just pure luck, but because they could, there's a couple of points where they were mobbed. But yeah, and Jeff just sprinted through the firefight down the wing towards the warp portal to escape.
They call him Usain Lightning Bolt.
Usain Fireball.
So yeah, that was, I mean, it was obviously a challenge given that we didn't successfully complete the mission, but definitely much more challenging and thus enjoyable, I would say, than the last time we played, where it just seemed like we kind of steamrollered the NPCs.
Yeah, no, yeah. Yeah, because I think we were both at the end of the last game was like, is the balance out completely in this game? Because it just was, it was like a walk in the park, at least kind of in terms of the gameplay, whereas today's at least looks more like a walk in the park with, with the green field. But yeah, no, it was right on the edge, you know, right up until the end. It could have gone either way. We just rolled a higher roll than we needed on the turn clock for that last turn. But if we'd rolled a couple of low ones, we could have made it to the end. We'd managed to reasonably clear a path. Jeff was running. He needed to get Clive and Urson off as well, but they were pretty close too. They were a turn, maybe two turns away as well. Bad luck with Tremors, yeah.
So the heroes at the moment are all flat. Like, they all work the same way.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been playing about trying to figure out a way to make the heroes a little bit different. So this is just an option of what I've got in mind. So like I say, at the moment, your heroes are just all the same. Like, they hit the same, they move the same, etc., etc. So say we had different options. So say you had, again, these are all cliches, but you've got your tank. So like, he is harder to wound, but like is a bit slower. Nothing.
You're thinking like a dwarf, basically, or someone in really heavy armor.
Exactly. An assassin is another option. So they maybe deal two ones instead of one in melee, but they're a bit rubbish at ranged.
Mm-hmm.
A sniper, extra long range, obviously, but maybe can't shoot, you know, below 6 inches or that, because the gun's just...
Well, you just can only shoot over 12 inches.
Yeah.
Rather than shooting under 12 inches, which I think is everyone else at the moment, isn't it?
Then you've got a scout, so extra movement, basically, but a bit squishy, not very good in combat. And a medic, who obviously isn't a very good combat hero, but
could certainly have been useful for Barry.
Yeah, exactly. So that's kind of what I'm thinking of now with this game. Is I really like, you know, it still needs some tweaks, but I think now being able to build a warband that like has specializations, that wouldn't necessarily be your 6 heroes. You might just have 3 of them, but I think it would add a wee bit more to it.
Oh yeah, no, like Urson had a big long rifle.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, would be fun to have him as a sniper.
Yeah. And then it becomes more tactical, doesn't it? Because you're not just using them all as, you know, they're not just the same. So it matters more about...
I mean, actually, but even with the way it is just now, today was quite a tactical game. There were bits where we were really having to think, like, how are we going to, you know, put enough distance between us and the enemy that we're not just going to end up enveloped in guys? And things like that, and how, because one guy, one hero on one NPC, even with the grunts, is not just a walk in the park on that one. So use that phrase again, but it's not just like you're going to steamroller over a grunt with one hero. You need at least 2 heroes to actually be inflicting enough wounds on average to be progressing across the board, which is what you really need to be doing with the game clock there. So,
yeah, it's food for thought. I would definitely like to experiment next time with even just having a couple of those more specialised heroes and just see how it works.
Yeah, no.
Or you just throw all 6 of them on and see like what works and what doesn't. So, but I mean, going back to this game itself, so it must have been satisfying, like you said at the start, just seeing that all getting a wee run on the table at last.
Yeah, I had a wee go with it at a games club a few weeks back. But yeah, it's really nice to see. And I got more of my Gene Stealers painted up recently, so that's their first time on the table. And Clive and Urson as well. They were painted specially for this game. And yeah, no, it's great. One of these things I've had in my head for years, and after a lot of work, I'm finally getting to the point where I can set up tables and have enough miniatures to play games all fully painted and things like that. I've nearly finished my Gene Stealer cultists as an army.
Mm-hmm.
I've just been building a land speeder from that for them. So I'm really looking forward. I'm going to use this scenery, and I've got a backdrop that my dad kindly painted for me. I'm going to take that classic white dwarf army shot once they're all done. And they're like, kind of really kind of motivates me to get it to get them finished. So, so yeah, no, it's great seeing all this stuff on the table, because having lost all my stuff back in the early, well, not lost, having got rid of all my stuff back in the early 2000s, it's that time building everything back up to the point where you've got a collection that you can use again. So,
yeah.
I mean, I've got a big collection of unpainted miniatures, but it's not the same. So,
big thanks to Callum for travelling through for that game. Like I say, I thoroughly did enjoy it and really appreciate not just the opportunity to play games like these with like-minded folks like Callum, but also to play with such amazing looking terrain and miniatures as well. It really is appreciated, and that's what this hobby is all about, isn't it? So there are pictures of this game too, and surprise, surprise, you'll find them in the Discord. So you've only really got one call to action, if you like, this episode, and that's to head on over to the Discord community, bedroombattlefields.com/Discord. All right, that is it for this episode of the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. Thanks as always for listening. I really do appreciate it, and we'll chat again on the next one.